here, guys. It just feels good. To come back and step up here. And Jackson Heights is such a special place, and I think that people who spend any amount of time here, even if maybe it's just one service, I think people realize that something special about this congregation. And we really appreciate you. We look forward to being here. We're excited about the week. And so we just hope that we'll have a really, really good week. We've really been anxious to be able to come back and see you and get reacquainted with old friends here. My parents are here this morning. I appreciate that. I've also got Lisa and CJ with me for the week. CJ's going to be going back with my parents for a few days, but he'll be back later in the week. When I was here 4 years ago, Lisa and I were dating then, and so many of you got to know her then. We're married now. We've got a little guy, and we're just glad that all of us can be able to be here. I wanted to begin this morning by talking a little bit about where we are now and what we're doing, what we're involved in, the work where we are. As many of you know, we were in Pensacola, Florida. We had gone there after the summer I spent with this group, and we were there for 2 or 3 years. And then that's when CJ was born. He had quite a few difficulties after his birth. He was in the hospital for about 3 months. And we decided that it would be better if we moved back to Birmingham, where I was brought up, where we had a lot of family and friends, and also medical facilities there were quite a bit better than they seemed to be in Pensacola. And I thought at that time that he was going to have cerebral palsy, and we decided to make that move back there for him. He ended up doing really, really well, and I then took a job with a church in South Carolina, and that's where we are now, in the Hilton Head area of South Carolina. It's the southernmost part of the state. Do I have a pointer here? Well, it's up there. Right at the Georgia, South Carolina line is where we are. And some of you may have been in that area on vacation before. I know that I said Rufus goes down there pretty often for meetings or whatnot. The area where we are is Beaufort. We are in Beaufort around the middle of the screen. There's Beaufort County, and then there's Beaufort the city. Beaufort the city is within Beaufort County. This area really is just a bunch of islands. It's a chain of islands there in the that southern corner in the coast. So you've got Paris Island, which I'll talk a bit about in a minute. There's Ladies Island east of that, which isn't labeled. There's St. Helena Island, Honey Island, Fripp Island, Pritchard's Island, Hilton Head Island. Hilton Head's an island. And so this area is just a lot of little pieces of land. You can't hardly go anywhere without going over a bridge. Just a lot of bays, a lot of rivers, just a lot of water in the area. And so we're kind of in the center right around here. Beaufort is a very, very beautiful place. It's an old historic area. If you've ever spent any time in South Carolina or kind of North Georgia, you have that sort of look. There's lots of history there, lots of very old homes, just very old things there. There's a cemetery just down the street from where we live that began in 1712. And that's the oldest grave there. It is someone buried 1712. But I have a few pictures just to kind of show you the town. If you read novels about the Old West, or the Old West, the Old South, if you read novels about the Old South or watch movies placed in the Old South, and you see the big oak trees and the old Victorian homes, that really is what it looks like, where we are. It's a very beautiful area. This, I don't know, I got these pictures off the internet. I'm not for sure where this is, but this looks very similar to where we live in our neighborhood. We actually live in kind of the edge of the downtown historic district. The congregation has a preacher's house, and we live there. We've really, really enjoyed it. Very nice area. If the church didn't have a preacher's house, we wouldn't be able to afford that area there. But we've really liked it a lot. Some more pictures of the area. This isn't quite, it's a little darker, it's not quite as clear, but you can see you got this big tree in the front, which many of these homes have, and it's down in the front yard. They don't cut this is the same place, I believe. This is one of the larger ones that's in the area. There's some people in the movie industry that live in the area, directors, and there's also a couple actors that have some homes. This is one of the bed and breakfasts, I believe. Quite a few of them are turned into bed and breakfasts, and it's a tourist area. People come spend the weekend. This is downtown. They have a park downtown, the waterfront park, and the marina, and that's where this is. So that's not too far from where we live. This time of year, it's getting pretty busy. Lots of people will come. They'll go and see the old homes and take the historic tours, and we're also close to the coast, so people will come and spend a few days at the beach. It's getting pretty busy. About a third, probably, of our attendance last week at Fire Beach was visitors. And then we got Paris Island, which is really the big thing that we have going on there. If you enlist in the Marines and you are kind of the eastern United States, then you're going to go through Paris Island. And the congregation has been going out there pretty much since it was founded, about 40, 50 years ago. The man who founded the congregation, Red Qualls, was a pretty high-ranking Marine. He started the church that's in Beaufort. He was an elder for a number of years. He's still there, but he's in bad health now. But he started the work out there. And they go out there every Sunday and conduct services at the base. They're in boot camp for 13 weeks, usually, if everything goes well. During that time, they're not allowed to leave. They're not allowed really to have much contact at all with the outside world other than writing and receiving letters, but they're allowed 2 hours to worship on Sundays. And so we will go out there and conduct services for them. We'll have quite a few who are members of the church who will attend the worship service that we put on base. And there's quite a few who maybe they're just investigating, going from one service to another. There's a whole bunch that are out there. Many of them are just looking for something to do. If you have an opportunity, and of course not a Marine, but my understanding is if you have an opportunity to get away from your drill instructor, then that's what you do. And so on Sundays they have 2 hours to do that. And they can come and worship. This is our room where we are right now. We've kind of been bounced around a little bit in different facilities. The building where we are right now, there is, they call it the Religious Ministries Center. And just pretty much you name it, and it's there. There's a large Protestant service that goes on, but then there's the other services in another facility where we are. We're in there with Jews. I believe there's an Islam room, Jehovah's Witness, Muslim, or Mormon, I would say, Christian Science. Pretty much you know, any of those sort of groups are in there. And so this is where we are right now. We can see about 90 to 100 in this room, and most Sunday mornings, especially when things really get going and a lot of people are there, we'll be at a capacity pretty much every week. It's been slow the last few months, during the summer months, these last few months. They don't send quite as many out there, so we've been a little lower in numbers recently, but once it gets picked back up and rolling again, we'll be 90 to 100 every Sunday. Previously, we were in another facility that holds more, and they could have as many as 150, 200 that will come out there to those services. These guys get very spiritually minded, for the most part, when they are going through boot camp. They come to the realization that there's a chance they're going to go overseas and not come back, and they want to know what they need to do to be right with their Creator. And it's really an evangelism opportunity like no other. It is just such a great thing to be able to do. We've been there since November, and I haven't kept track down to the exact number, but somewhere in the 40 to 50 number as far as how many have been baptized since they've been there. Usually anywhere from 2 to 10 or so a month that we'll have. And it's just a really good thing. This was a special day. This was around Christmas. And when you're working within the Marines, like we are, you're very much don't want you in a certain room, then you don't go in that room. They may not even have a reason. They just say, well, you're not allowed in there anymore, and then that's that. Well, there is a room for the baptistry. They have one room where there's a baptistry that we were able to go in. And around the holidays, they were using that room for a nativity scene. And they told us, well, for the month of December, you can't go in there. So that meant we couldn't baptize anybody during that month. So what happened was we had these guys, seven or eight during that month, who all wanted to be baptized, and we kept telling them, well, they're not allowing us to do that right now. You know, we'll let you know when they let us back in there. Well, once the nativity scene is over, once December passes, we get past Christmas, they then give us the go-ahead. They say, okay, next Sunday you guys can go back in there. So we all went, and all of these gentlemen were baptized that morning. One of them had already been, and then he got really involved and started helping out with a lot of things. It's just such a special time for them. I have really tried to keep in touch with them after they leave, and that has proved to be extremely difficult. And I know some in this congregation here have tried to help out with that also by writing letters and that sort of thing. And it has just been so hard to try to do that. They go home for a period of time, and then after that, most of them will go to Camp Lejeune, which is in North Carolina. And then there's another extended time where they can't have contact. And just through all of that, it's so hard to maintain any sort of a relationship. But what we are trying to do is myself and Carl McMurray, who many of you know or know of probably through Andrew. Andrew worked with him for a period of time. He owns a publishing company. And what we're working on is putting together a publication that's going to be sent out to Christians in the military. And we're going to try to fund that through individual support, through individual donations. So if, I either at our local church or at Paris Island, I meet somebody in the Marines, they can have a subscription. If you know someone who's in another branch of the service, they can have a subscription. And so it's looking like probably about $12 to $13 for an issue. It's going to be a quarterly mailing. We're going to try to do it a hard mail copy, so that if they're in a place where there's no internet, they'll be able to have it. Also, so they can give it to somebody else. It just makes it a little more personal if it's something in their hand. And then we're also going to put it up online. But we're going to try to mail that out quarterly, put it out quarterly. And we're going to have several articles in there just meant to encourage them as they try to do what's right in a very, very difficult environment. Also, just some information that might be pertinent to them being in the service. Maybe some information on churches that are near bases. They might be able to write in and say, hey, I'm being deployed and going over here. And perhaps we can hook them up with somebody else and form a little group to worship when they're in the Afghanistan or wherever it is that they might be going. And so we're trying to fund that through individual support. We have a website that we're working on. It's still under construction, but it's going to be soldiersofchrist.us. If that's something that you have any interest in at all, soldiersofchrist.us. And if you want to buy a subscription for somebody, you can send us $12, and we'll take care of that. That'll be the last time this week that I ask you for any money. But if you have any interest at all, just check out that website, and hopefully we get all the kinks worked out of that. Soldiersofchrist.us, and you can send names to us. If you know somebody that's in the service that you think might want to get the paper, you can send their name to us, or just however you might want to help out. Just check that out. Let's turn over our Bibles to Psalm 73. We'll just spend a few minutes in this psalm this morning. Psalm 73. As I mentioned earlier, CJ, after he was born at 1 pound 14 ounces, he then spent 101 days in the NICU. And for those who don't know, NICUs overall, it seems, kind of have a reputation as being sort of rough places. There was a baby next to CJ for a period of time. The mother was mentally handicapped to some extent. And the rumor was that it was an uncle who was the father of that. both here in the NICU, so you can imagine his visitation would probably be pretty interesting, to say the least. There was a place where there would be babies that had addictions, and you would hear them crying out for the drug that was no longer available to them. There were cases of abuse, where a baby would go home, it would be abused right away, and then it would come into the NICU. And so for most of those who were there, there was some preventable reason, it seemed, some external circumstance that could have been prevented as to why they were there. But the thing was that those people all got to go home with healthy children. And there were other families there who, just from outward appearances, seemed like they were good families, just good moral people. And it was their babies that had all the problems. And some of them didn't get to go home at all. They didn't survive. And it's in times like that that you can begin to wonder, is there really any benefit to doing the right thing? When those who are clearly living lives that aren't right, and it seems like they've got it better than those who are trying to do the right thing. Does God really watch over his people? Does he really answer their prayers? When it seems like those who aren't trying to even do right get the answer that I want. And that's a question that the writer of Psalm 73 has. Why is it that people who do wrong seem to be the ones who have it better? And that's the question that he has. And if you think a little bit about Jewish tradition, it makes this maybe come to life a little more. The Jewish tradition, the Jewish idea was that if you do what is good in God's eyes, then you get good things. You're blessed. If you do what is wrong in God's eyes, then something bad happens to you. Think about Job. The way the people in the book of Job say to Job, well, why? You must have sinned because all these bad things are happening. What did you do wrong? That sort of thing. Over in the Gospels, in John, where Jesus, he goes to the blind man, and if you remember the question that's asked there, as the disciples look at this blind man, they say, who sinned? This man is blind, so who sinned? Was it his parents? Was it him? Who sinned? He's got something bad, so somebody must have done something bad. Well, the writer of this song, he looks out and he says, well, what I see is people who are doing wrong, and yet it seems like they've got it all. And that doesn't make sense. I want us this morning to look at when good things happen to bad people. We have a phrase, when bad things happen to good people, and it's actually a book. But what about when there's good things that happen to bad people? I want us to think about that for a few minutes this morning. Let's begin Psalm 73 and in verse 1. Truly God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled, my steps had nearly slipped. For I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. I want us to go through and look at a few other verses that we have in this psalm, and these are taken from different translations that I've found. In verse 4, he says, I never had to suffer, they stay healthy. Look out at those who aren't doing right, and they seem like they've got it all. They don't have any problems. They don't have any struggles. They're healthy, living well. They just don't have troubles like everyone else. They're living a high life. They're living it up. No difficulties, and yet they're doing wrong. In verse 6, he says, pride is their necklace. These are prideful people. These are arrogant people. And yet it seems that they're taken care of. In verse 7, their eyes swell out through fatness. And when I read this, I get the image of a person who is so fat that their eyes are about to just pop out of their head. In those times, being overweight, being whatever words you like, plump, obese, I think it's pretty good. You had enough food, you had a comfortable enough lifestyle that you could get that way. And so the writer of this song, he looks out and he says, when I see the fat people, they're the ones who seem to be blessed. Or when I see the wicked, let me rephrase that. When I see the wicked, they're the ones who are the fat. It should be the other way around. The ones who are doing right should have an abundance, and they should be blessed. They should have comforts. But he says it's the other way around. In verse 8, they sneer and say cruel things, and because of their pride, they make violent threats. And they look down on people. They're malicious. In verse 12, behold, these are the wicked, always at ease. They increase in riches. And what they have, it just seems like they get more and more of it. And they're always comfortable. They're always at ease, increasing. And so he comes to this conclusion in verse 13 that apparently to do right, it's just a big waste of time. What good did it do me to keep my thoughts pure and refuse to do wrong? Why do I even try? Why do I even try to do the right thing if the ones who are doing wrong are going to have a better life than I do? It must just be a big waste of time. And then he says in verse 16, and I thought, how to understand this? It seemed to me a wearisome task. I'm just getting worn out trying to make sense of this. It's confusing. It's perplexing how I'm trying to do the right thing, and yet it seems that others have a better life than I do. This just makes no sense at all. And then we come to verse 17. He says in verse 17, until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I discerned their end. He hasn't thought too much about God throughout this psalm, it seems. He's thought quite a bit about them and why do they have it so good. And he's thought quite a bit about me, myself, and I, and why I don't have what I would like to. But there hasn't really been much of a mention made of God until we come to verse 17. He says, when he turns to God, when he thinks of God, when he goes into the sanctuary of God, and he shifts his perspective a little bit, it's then that things start to make more sense. And if you read the rest of this psalm, the focus is now shifted. And now it's not about them, it's not about me, but rather it's about you, O God, and what you have done for me, and what you will do to them. Verse 18, truly you set them in slippery places. You make them fall to ruin. How they are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors, like a dream when one awakens. O Lord, when you rouse yourself, you despise them as phantoms. When my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in hearts, I was brutish and ignorant. I was like a beast toward you. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. For behold, those who are far away from you shall perish. You put an end to everyone who is unfaithful to you. But for me, it is good to be near God. I have made the Lord God my refuge, that I may tell of all of your works. So in this psalm, we have these three perspectives. And it's those three perspectives that I want us to consider for just a minute. In part of this psalm, he spends a lot of time thinking about me, thinking about I, thinking about myself. And poor little old me, what I don't have versus what they do have. And maybe we in our lives do that sometimes ourselves. Maybe we think about what we don't have in regards to health, or in regards to a financial situation, or a career situation, or a work situation, or whatever it might be. And we just think about me. Many of us maybe are familiar with this little story, but I thought it would illustrate this point pretty well. Today upon a bus, I saw a lovely maid with golden hair. I envied her. She seemed so happy, and how I wished I were so fair. suddenly she rose to leave. I saw her hobble down the aisle. She had one foot and wore a crutch, but as she passed, a smile. Oh, God, forgive me when I whine. I have 2 feet. The world is mine. And when I stopped to buy some sweets, the lad who served me had such charm. He seemed to radiate good cheer. His manner was so kind and warm. I said, it's nice to deal with you. Such courtesy I seldom find. He turned and said, oh, thank you, sir. And then I saw that he was blind. Oh, God, forgive me when I whine. I have 2 eyes. The world is mine. Then when walking down the streets, I saw a child with eyes of blue. He stood and watched the others play. It seemed he knew not what to do. I stopped a moment, then I said, why don't you join the others, dear? He looked ahead without a word, and then I knew he could not hear. Oh, God, forgive me when I whine. I have 2 ears. The world is mine. With feet to take me where I go, with eyes to see the sunset's glow, with ears to hear what I would know, I am blessed indeed. The world is mine. Oh, God, forgive me when I whine. And maybe it's that we think too much about me. It may be, though, that we think too much about others, and that produces within us a jealousy. We just wish that we could have what they have. And it's just not fair that they don't have respect for God, and yet they're doing better than I am. And maybe that comes forth in jealousy of others. Jealousy and thankfulness can't live together. If you remember that sitcom, The Odd Couple, many of you probably remember that many years ago. Yeah, The Odd Couple, these two guys, they were so different. They just had trouble living together. And thankfulness and jealousy, it's kind of like The Odd Couple. Those two things can't reside in the same place. You can't be thankful for what God has given you and at the same time be jealous of somebody else. Those two things can't live together. If you turn over to Psalm 37, where our Bible reading was from. Psalm 37 is much the same as Psalm 73 as far as the topic that's being discussed and the questions behind this psalm. Psalm 37 is attributed to David, whereas Psalm 73 is by Asaph. Psalm 37 in verse 1 says, fret not yourself because of evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers. And that's how this psalm, taking up the same subject, begins. Fret not. Don't worry. Don't be anxious. Don't be jealous. But rather think of all the things that we have through God and how much we are in fact blessed. I think about the nation of Israel in 1 Samuel, where they looked at the other nations and they said, they have a king. We'd like to have one of those too. We want a king. If you know the rest of the history, well, having a king doesn't go very well for them. And God even said that he wanted to be their king. But they looked out and they judged themselves by what the others had. Well, our psalmist, he thinks about himself and he thinks perhaps too much about others. But he gets his answer when he changes his focus and he then thinks about God. If you're there in Psalm 37 still, the same conclusion is reached in this psalm. As far as how do we make sense of this? Well, we make sense of this in just knowing that God is in control and that we trust Him, that He will, in fact, take care of us. And he reaches this conclusion a little earlier than does Asaph. In verse 3, he pretty much tells us the answer in the beginning of the psalm. Verses 3 through 7. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness. He really gives us 4 answers here. The first is trust. Trust in the Lord, dwell in the land, and befriend faithfulness. Second, delight yourself in the Lord, for He will give you the desires of your heart. Number 3, commit your way to the Lord. Trust in Him, and He will act. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light, and your justice as the noonday. Number chapter 4, be still before the Lord. And wait patiently for him. Fret not over the one who prospers in his way, over the man who carries out evil devices. Many of the Psalms will move in threefold structure, or a threefold movement. Many of the Psalms begin with frustration, with confusion, with questions. God, why is my enemy prevailing? Why are the wicked blessed? When will you hear me? When will you answer me? And then somewhere in that psalm, in some of them, there's this epiphany. There's this aha moment. Now I get it. Now I understand. And then after that, all the psalmist can do is praise and glorify God for what he has done in his life. If you think about Psalm 73, it follows that structure to a T. In Psalm 73, verses 1 through around 15 or so, you've got this confusion, this uncertainty. Why are the wicked blessed? Maybe I've just kept my heart clean in vain. Maybe it's just been a waste of time. I don't understand this. This is wearisome. But then in verses 16 and 17, he starts to get it when he goes into the sanctuary of God. And then after that, it's all about you, O God. And I'd ask this morning, where are you in this psalm? Make this psalm your psalm. The superscription says a psalm of Asaph, but put your name in there. So I think the truth is that all of us, at different parts of our lives, we've been where he is. I don't understand. This doesn't make sense. Why are they getting the answer to my prayer, it seems. And after making this psalm your psalm, I'm asking, where are you in this psalm? There's three parts of this psalm. Where are you? Maybe there's some of us in here who, in our lives, we're somewhere between verses 1 and 15. And we have doubts, and we have questions, we have confusion. We wonder why things aren't going the way we'd like for them to. Maybe there's some of us in here who in our lives are around verses 16 and 17 in this psalm. We're starting to go to the right place for the answer. We're starting to realize what life is about. And I suspect there's many of us who in this psalm, we are at verses 18 through the end. We realize what God has done for us in our lives. And now all we can do is thank him and praise him for how he's taken care of us, how he has delivered us. So where are you in this psalm? If you haven't yet found the answers to this life, I encourage you to keep looking. Keep trying to find those answers. Keep looking at God. And the psalmist, through God, finds his answers. It's not when he thinks about others. It's not when he thinks about himself. It's when he goes into the sanctuary. I did this sermon out in Missouri in a meeting I did out there. And somebody came up to me afterwards. And they said that they remember being told a little saying that when you look at others,